I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the more readable books of this past fall is the latest by Craig Custins. In the franchise, the business of building winning teams, he talks to several notable general managers, a couple of owners, and an Olympic medalist who all play senior roles in various NHL franchises. What Mr. Custins, who joins me now, gleans from his frank, personal conversations is how each one dealt with the various problems that teams encounter on the road to winning the Stanley Cup, whether it's juggling a salary cap or trading a player, or how to deal with the interpersonal issues of professional athletes. The book is full of great stories. In his conversations with Jim Rutherford, currently the Canucks president of hockey operations, who for many years headed up the Pittsburgh NHL team, leading it to back-to-back Stanley Cup wins, Rutherford is revealed to be successful at listening to everybody he encounters, especially a team's ownership. In conversations with Tampa Bay's Julien Brisebois or the Penguins' Kyle Dubas, we learn about how the path to managing in the NHL may not have come from having played the game. Brad Treliving, Jim Neal, and Lou Lamoriello, among others, each provide great insight in their interviews with Craig for this book. All have principles that have guided them to success and sustained them through losses. There's no one formula to get a winning team, but taken as a whole, the book provides an appreciation on how to manage an operation as complex as a professional hockey team, or anything else for that matter. And a lot of them read, too. It's fun seeing all the various books that people in the book recommend as necessary reading. If you go to Craig's website at craigcustins.com, you can get a PDF checklist. Craig Custins is an acclaimed writer who has covered hockey at ESPN and The Athletic. His previous book is Behind the Bench, Inside the Minds of Hockey's Greatest Coaches. He also hosted the interview podcast, The Full 60. Currently, he is the head of creative development at The Athletic, a New York Times company. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Craig joined me from Detroit earlier this week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Craig Custins. Mr. Custins, good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good yourself. Thanks for joining us.
Great.
What I enjoyed about your book, The Franchise, is that these are marvelous stories, and they're not just interesting if you follow sports, but if you're managing anybody or leading anybody or any leadership role in any kind of business, there's something to glean from this book, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, that was my hope at the outset, was kind of striking that balance so I had enough kind of behind-the-scenes hockey stories and some stories behind trades and signings and hirings and firings for people that were just into that. But really, in my heart, like, you know, I come from a family of teachers. I help lead the organization at The Athletic. And so just kind of producing some leadership lessons and some insights that anybody can pick up, whether or not they're diehard hockey fans or not, was really the hope there. And it seems like the response I've gotten is, you know, it does seem like that's happening. So I'm thrilled about that.
And the other fascinating thing is that one needn't have played the game, say, to get into the management role. I mean, they get a lot of flack for not having played hockey. But, you know, a few of these guys in the book have never played the game, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, what I tried to do was provide a balance of a couple of things. One was a look at people at different points in their career. So you have folks like Jim Rutherford or Lou Lamoriello who have been around a long time. Mm-hmm. And then there's people like, you know, Kyle Dubas, who's still pretty young and early-ish in his career. And then you have somebody like Megan Duggan, who is, I think, a future GM. And so you have that mix. And then I tried to find a mix of people who were, you know, former player types. If you look at Jim Neal, this is a guy that was, you know, longtime player, mixed in with someone like Julien Brisebois, who grew up a baseball player, like was, you know, wanted to be essentially like a tax accountant or tax lawyer, was not, I don't think he had aspirations of being an NHL GM at the outset. But, you know, you could argue right now he might be the league's best general manager. So, yeah, I try to find a mix of different backgrounds in there.
Let's start close to home. I'm talking to you from Vancouver. Jim Rutherford, obviously, is an important part of the team here. And when he came to Vancouver, one of the parts of the job he said was managing up, managing the owner, as it were. First of all, you've talked to him over the years. was that probably, because he's never talked about this publicly, and you've probably asked him and he's never said anything. Was that one of the reasons why he left Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of people, I tried to get into that with him. You know, when I sat down with Jim, it was, I want to say a few months after he left the Penguins. And so we were sitting in a country club just outside Pittsburgh, and it was still fairly fresh. And so, you know, he wasn't dying to get into that. But I think relationship with owner was something that he talked a lot about. And so it's funny because he, you know, when he got hired by the Canucks, he went, you know, as part of the press conference, went on stage and talked about the importance of managing up. And I started laughing because I was like, him and I talked at length about that for this book. And I was partly disappointed because I was like, oh, this is gold. I don't want him to talk about it elsewhere. But I thought it was just this great insight into Jim, because when you talk about leadership and you talk about running a team, that's something people are often afraid to say. Like, it's about culture building. It's about, you know, player roster development, all those different things. Very rarely do you hear someone say, hey, I have to manage my owner. And, you know, he's done that in Vancouver. And we talked a lot about how he did it in Carolina with Pete Karmanos, who was a big personality, and with that comes an ego. And I think one of the stories that Jim Rutherford told, he learned, and this is a good example of how he manages, he learned with Pete Karmanos that you didn't want to get into an argument with him in the moment. Like, if he disagreed with a move or something that you suggested, Jim just said, you know, I would let him sit with it for a few days, and then I would circle back and kind of present my argument again and really kind of rally behind some points. And he said he was often way more reasonable in that moment. And that's just like this small example of how somebody understands that you're not going to win every battle in the moment, or understands there's different personalities when you're talking about ownership, and really learn how to manage it.
Yeah, and this owner here in Vancouver, Aquilini, I mean, the relationship seems to be good now because they seem to have been doing quite well, but he is known as an owner who does like to meddle with certain appointments. You know, like he appointed the last coach. I guess they're doing all right while they're doing okay, but, I mean, that's the case with a lot of these owners throughout the league, that if the team isn't doing as well, they do want to take a hand in things, right?
For sure, and, I mean, that was, you know, I'm sure it's the case locally, but nationally, and covering the Canucks for years, that was the criticism of that organization, was ownership. And oftentimes, when a team underachieves for a long period of time, and you cycle through coaches, and you cycle through general managers, the one constant is the owner. And I think one of the things that Jim Rutherford has done well there is you're not hearing that as much anymore in Vancouver. And it is pretty common that owners, they want to be hands-on. And I actually, one of my favorite chapters to report was the one around Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon, in large part because when you talk to people in hockey, they say, hey, you want your owner to be hands-off. You want them to hire the folks in hockey and let them do their job. Like, that's what you hear a lot. And he's the opposite. This is somebody who's calling his GM 8 to 10 to 12 times a day, and he's watching AHL games, and he's calling other GMs and agents and media members. And Tom Dundon is extremely hands-on, and it's actually working. And it seems to be kind of against the norm, and I was just fascinated to dive in to look at why that was the case.
And that's the great thing about the book, is that, you know, someone might pick this up and think, okay, let's follow everything in here, and we'll have a winning team. But it does. There are teams where the owner does have to play a part. There are teams where the owner doesn't play a part at all. There's no real formula, is there, to a winning team? And you can't take an example that works, say, in one city in the south of the United States and bring it to Vancouver, for example.
No, I think that's one of the conclusions. Is, you know, I get asked that a lot. Oh, okay, what's the secret? Or, hey, will you? I've had people now recently say, will you send this to the Buffalo Sabres so they can learn how to build a winning team? And it's like, hey, look, like, there's a lot of paths to success. And in some cases, you know, I spent some time with Ted Leonsis in the Washington Capitals and Brian McClellan. They were really patient with their team, and they stuck with their core. There was a point where Nicklas Backstrom wanted to be traded, and they talked openly about that in the book in ways that I really hadn't seen. And I thought it was fascinating where they were like, no, we're going to stick with this. Same thing. I mean, this is kind of the eternal debate in Toronto. And Kyle Dubas went through that, and we talked a lot about that. And yet you have somebody in Vegas and George McPhee who I would say wasn't patient with a group of players. And that team was an expansion team. They go to the Cup Final. There's a lot of people that are like, oh, this is going to be the team moving forward. And he just determined he had this really high standard for what it takes to win in the NHL and what it takes to win a Stanley Cup. And he essentially blew that team up. And when they ended up winning a Cup, it was with new players, with the Jack Eichels and the Petrangelos. And so those are two different strategies. Those are two different management styles. And it just kind of underlines that there's a lot of different paths to get there to win in the NHL.
The chapter on Lou Lamoriello I found fascinating because here's a guy that we all know, but we don't know a lot about. And so, you know, the easy thing to say after reading that part of the book is to say, well, I haven't learned anything new. But we do learn a lot about him, don't we? I mean, at the end of the day, he's crafted this image about himself that almost makes him unknowable. But you managed to penetrate that. And, you know, he has these core values that have stuck with him and that have worked for him for a number of years, haven't they?
Yeah, that was a fascinating one because I did spend a lot of time with him. You know, we went and we did an interview in his office, and then we went out to a nice, like, Italian dinner, which was exactly how you would expect with Lou, you know, corner of a nice restaurant with a glass of wine. And you know, at the end of the day, though, like, I don't think he's not going to be overly sharing kind of his processes. But I learned a couple things. I mean, I learned this is somebody who is really he's constantly learning. He's somebody who's still reading constantly. He's talking to people. He's evolving in terms of just wanting to learn more. And I think what I learned about him is that started at a really young age. For a long time, he was always the youngest in the sport he was in. He was a young AD in college. And so he just felt like he had to constantly work with mentors and work with older people. And that mentality of constantly trying to get better all the time is still happening with him, which I thought is pretty fascinating with Lou. But then, as you said, he still has his core values. He has his things that aren't going to change. And, you know, there's people that feel like some of that's old-fashioned and his, you know, the game has passed some of it by. But I think that's what makes him so fascinating.
Yeah, like a lot of the grooming issues and the dress issues.
The grooming,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
You mentioned...
Pardon
me.
No, I was just going to say, like, I've talked to players who are like, you know, I would never want to play for him for those reasons. You know, and so, like, not everyone loves it.
You mentioned in that meeting in his office where you're interviewing him that someone from the Islanders sat in with both of you, and he made a crack about Joe Biden and how you know there's someone there in the office to make sure he doesn't say what he's not supposed to say to you as a reporter. Did that person follow you to the restaurant?
That's a great question. No, he didn't. I think we waited him out, I guess, at some level. And, you know, the funny thing is that was Kimber. He works for the Islanders, who I've known a long time. And, you know, it was less somebody kind of trying to overlook it. I think Kimber was just interested in sitting in and hearing part of the interview. And he ended up – it was the only case where this happened, where I had a third party that was part of the interview. And Kimber ended up being really helpful. Like, Lou would mention something, and he just would – add to the story or provide some detail. So I think Lou, you know, here was Lou. He's making a joke saying, hey, they're worried that here I am at this point in my career and I might say something that they don't want out there.
Yeah. The stuff about Fedosov and how he came to play in the NHL, I mean, there's a lot of cloak and dagger stuff. It's really exciting to read that in that part of the book. Lamoriello really does take a lot of risk in going over there he even says that he was nuts to do that sort of stuff, right? But I can see he didn't know that at the time, did he?
No, like that was, you know, I talked to Lou, and the reason I included that story was just to really show the lengths he would go to improving his roster. And so he, you know, he goes over there, he's trying to recruit a player who wasn't allowed to come over that he drafted. And you know, Lou didn't share a ton of the story. He basically said, if you want to hear this story, you have to talk to Slava. And so I was able to get Slava Fetisov on the phone, and I talked to him, and I ended up, this is one of the, you know, a lot of times I didn't go back to the original person I interviewed. In this case, I did to make sure I understood, I was understanding Slava correctly, because he's like, hey, he went over there, you know, without a visa, he, you know, it was a lot of cloak and dagger, and he's just like, this guy risked his life. And Slava was like, he did it because he cared and he wanted to build his team. And then he said years later, he was having dinner with
with Lou Lamoriello and just said, hey, I don't think you understand how much you were at risk coming to my country and trying to lure me over, bring me over. Like, that was, you know, and Lou, and Slavo provided a few more details, and Lou was like, okay, you know, now he could say, okay, that was kind of crazy. But I guess in the moment, you don't realize it.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about building a winner.
And then the fascinating thing, and not having known any of this stuff before, or knowing the manager or the player, is that when it doesn't work out, he trades him to Detroit, where it does work out, doesn't it?
Yeah, and so that whole arc kills me, because he goes over there and essentially risks his life, and then it doesn't work out. He's not a good fit on the team, and so he trades him, and then brings him back as a coach, and then he fires him, and so. Like, that just gets at Lou. Like, Lou's big thing that, you know, came up a couple times is you have to make tough decisions, and you can't wait on it. And he's just like, as a leader, you know the things you have to do. The people in the organization know the things you have to do, and you have to act on it. And he doesn't let personal feelings or loyalties get in the way of making what he feels are the right decisions.
And even players who've gone to arbitration with him still remain loyal, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, there's people that he's traded, that he's gone to arbitration with, that he's gotten in arguments with. And look, not everyone loves him. I don't want to, like, paint that picture. But, you know, I think Bill Guerin at one point asked for a trade. And when I called Bill Guerin to talk about him, he's just like, this is a guy that, you know, I think of as a father. The way I run the team in Minnesota, there's shades of Lou Lamoriello in everything I do. And you can just see the huge impact he had.
That impact, do you see that in Kyle Dubas as well?
Yeah, I mean, it manifests itself in different ways, I felt like, with Kyle. I think, certainly the way that Kyle ran the Maple Leafs was influenced by Lou Lamoriello. I think what Lou allowed Kyle to do when he was working for him was to focus on, have very clear understanding what his job was, and very clear kind of lanes in which to operate, which he didn't have previously. And I think Kyle learned the value of that, even if he probably wasn't thrilled with it in the moment as it was happening. I just look at how Kyle ran the organization and the rules that he implemented with Toronto, even how he dealt with the media. Like, Kyle was, there was a bit of Lou there and a little bit more secrecy than maybe there would have been in the past if he hadn't been influenced by Lou. And you definitely saw those connections.
The chapter on Megan Duggan I found rather exciting, because you chronicle her Olympic ups and downs and then how that applies to her work now with the New Jersey Devils. It's fascinating to see just how the league is changing, not just with her, but, you know, you have the two assistant general managers here in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. You have the assistant coach in Seattle. I mean, these aren't one-offs, are they? I mean, this is a hopefully a trend, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's growing. I mean, obviously, in terms of women's influence and leadership in the game, it's not where it needs to be. But, you know, there was, in talking to Megan, who, I mean, you mentioned Vancouver. Like, I believe Cammy Granato's going to run a team if she wants to at one point. I believe Megan Duggan's going to run the team when she gets that opportunity. And I forgot if it was Cammy or Megan who told the story, but they were at the draft a couple years ago. I think it was in Nashville, and one of them was in a suite, and they were looking down at the draft floor at all the different women at draft tables, which definitely wasn't a thing, you know, years ago. And they were calling them and texting them and connecting them. They would say, "Hey, do you know I'm at that team's table? She's over there, and make sure you go introduce." And it was this cool, like, coordination of making sure they were all working together. And I know they all got together in Nashville, and at one point. Just to connect and network, and I mean, that's all going to pay off. But we're going to see that growth continue.
And I mean, the their work here, Castonguay and Granato in Vancouver. I mean, the team really changed as soon as they came to town, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think of those two. I know Cammy a little bit, and have just been. I'm American, and so, you know, she's somebody who was a legend here as a player, and you saw the influence she had not only on the teams that she led, but the next generation of women players for Team USA. And now she's getting that opportunity in Vancouver in that front office. And again, all those all those traits that made her a great player and a great leader on a team translate so well into a front office.
I was quite moved, Craig, by when you wrote about Chris Snow. And you wrote about him in the context of the chapter on Jim Tree Living. Was it in, I guess they started working with one another before Calgary, is that right?
It was in Calgary. That's okay. Where they started. And then, yeah, and, you know, the thing about Chris, he was a former media member. So this is a guy that wasn't a hockey lifer who constantly had to prove himself over and over again. And when Brad Tree Living got that job in Calgary as the GM, he's sitting there going, okay, this guy didn't hire me. I'm going to have to prove myself, and this is going to be a challenge. And one of the reasons I told the story, I just tried to use stories as a way to show how these people run an organization and run a team. And I thought the way that Brad got to know Chris and didn't, it's easy for somebody else to come in as a GM and just fire everybody from the mm-hmm. previous regime. And it would have been totally understandable if he did that with Chris. He did not. He got to know him, and then he learned. He said, at one point, it was clear he was the smartest guy in the room. And he started to expand his role and his influence in the organization. That just speaks volumes of the kind of person Brad Tree Living is, how he's willing to give somebody a shot, how he's willing to evaluate people. And then, I caught Brad at the start of his, when he was hired in Toronto, and just to see how he handled that in a short period of time. And he just said it was trial by fire and you're drinking out of a fire hose. But again, it's getting to know people. It's managing people, because at the end of the day, you're only going to be good in this role is the people around you. And I think Brad realizes that as much as anybody.
I called him Jim in the question. I actually just found that out as I was reading the book, that the two of them were related. I guess not a lot of people know that.
No, I talked to Shane Doan for the book, and he's like, I had no idea until I saw Jim, after a game one time. And I mean, I think that captures Brad so well, right? Here is this guy who's making it on his own merit, who, could play that card. I never had, I'm in the States, so this, I didn't have the exposure, but you never would know it talking to Brad. I would say that.
And that's the fascinating thing is that Brad Tree Living begins to delegate to Snow, even contracts and the sort. And early on, when he was working with Brian Burke, he learned to speak up, didn't he, about things that he was, Burke had told him. If there is something that you disagree with, or you have, some ideas, say something, right?
Yeah, I love that story from Brian Burke too. That was, Chris Snow disagreed with Brian over a player evaluation, if I remember correctly, and said it in a meeting, and then
he apologized.
Pulled him aside. Yeah, apologized. And he said, "Hey, I was out of line," or whatever he says to Brian in the moment, and he says, "No, I want to surround myself with people who disagree with me." And he, instead of putting him in his place, he empowered him. And again, that's, I think that speaks volumes about the leadership.
Well, when you talked to Brian, Brian McClellan, is that his name? The mm-hmm. manager in Washington. It seems like from my reading of it, that he's in that job just as long as Ovechkin is there. Because you do talk to him about succession planning and what happens, he's been in that role for a long time now. He seems just tied to, he's just waiting out whatever happens to Ovechkin if he decides to retire. If he'd retired 2 years ago, he'd have left too, right? Is that your sense?
Well, I don't know. An interesting thing that happened post, me writing this book was Brian moving upstairs and another GM coming in, and it really did align with what he was saying. And I think succession plan is another really interesting thing about leadership to talk about. And what Brian was, when I caught him, it was at a trade deadline in which he was trading a lot of players away from the Capitals in a bit of a rebuild. And these were players that had helped him win a Stanley Cup, and it was painful for him. He was just like, it was just brutal. It was heart-wrenching to talk to him in that moment. And he was expressing that. And I think what he was saying is, in his mind, when you get to that rebuild and you get to that next generation of players, and whoever it is post-Alex Ovechkin, in the Washington Capitals, in his mind, he was like, you probably need a new voice in here to kind of turn the page. And you know, you've seen that with teams where they win a Stanley Cup, but it's not until they bring in a new voice that can really truly do the rebuild where they have success.
Yeah, that's you contrast that with Lamoriello, who seems like he's been there forever and looks like he'll be there forever. Well, I don't know, you know, how well the Islanders do this year. There really isn't a, you know, there isn't a plan here or a timeline for any of these guys, right?
I mean,
you can apply somewhere else.
Someone like Lou is interesting, right? Like, I think it's different for each person. But that was the criticism of Lou Lamoriello with the Devils, if you remember, was they needed to rebuild. They had all that success, and you know, Lou's only kind of his mentality is one thing, and that's to constantly win and to push. And there, I know there was a lot of fans that believed it was time to tear it down, and it wasn't until they brought in Ray Sherrow and they moved Lou out a little bit in New Jersey where they were able to do that. And so, like, that just goes with kind of a different mentality. And it's, you know, I know there are some GMs who are just clearly better at trying to win, which is, I mean, I guess everyone's job versus developing young players or rebuilding a franchise from scratch. And so, but yeah, I mean, I think that was a criticism of Lou's for a while there in New Jersey.
So I'm sure you've been following, Craig, what's going on here in Vancouver. You know, this talk about two players on the team not getting along and the sort. I don't know what's true in the story because both players deny there's a beef. The coach has said that there has you know, conceded that there's something going on. Even the captain has as well. You know, a lot of people say it's the media making all this stuff up. Let's say there is a beef between two players on a team. What role does the manager have? I mean, does the manager come in right away, or is that dealt, say, with in the locker room first? And if that doesn't work, does that then go up to the management?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I would say if you talk to coaches and managers, I think the best teams, this stuff is policed by the players themselves. Mm. And so I think championship teams, again, I have no details on what's going on in Vancouver. Maybe, you know, years from now we can tell the story accurately until there's a little bit of distance there. But I do know in talking to coaches and GMs through the years, they'll tell you when there's issues like this that creep up, it's best handled with the players. And the best teams are the ones where the players are pushing the envelope in terms of leadership and settling these things within the room. And if that doesn't happen, and the coach, you know, can't stop the feud, then you have to start moving it up the food chain. And that goes back to, you know, I don't think it was a feud, but you know, the chapter about the Washington Capitals, Nicklas Backstrom basically saying, we can't win with this team as mm-hmm. it's constructed, and I want out. And he's, you know, he communicated that to the GM, and that went all the way to ownership, and Ted Leonsis saying, I'm not doing this. Like, I'm not acquiescing here. We're like, we're going to win with this team, and it's up to us to figure this out with the team that we have. And so if the players can't settle it, you start working your way up from there.
The other thing on the Pettersson issue, because he hasn't been producing, Patrick Alvin has been talking about that in the media. I'm curious to know... I'm sure they've had conversations with one another, the management and the player.
Yeah.
When the management takes it to the media and puts it out there, is that a strategy you've seen used elsewhere in the league?
Yeah, I mean, I think different people have different ways of handling it, and I would say I'm not surprised to hear that's how that's being handled, because Jim Rutherford, who's at the top there, is somebody who was always really honest in assessing his players and where they stood. And, you know, I know generally when you talk to people around the league, it's kind of, if you're going to be critical, you do that privately. And if you're going to praise, you do that publicly. But if that's not working, or you see this as an opportunity to light a fire or whatever, I think people have different strategies. But, I'm not surprised to see that, because Jim Rutherford always, in his organizations, he's somebody that would give you an honest assessment of what was going on, and I'm sure that's the culture there.
Yeah, I mean, he was talking about Bruce Boudreau in the media, and it seemed like they were talking about Boudreau's production or you know, his skill as a coach. in the media, and it seemed like they weren't talking to one another behind the scenes at all.
Yeah. I don't know how healthy that was.
Yeah.
Back in the, I remember that, and I'm sure if we talked to Bruce, he would say that was not an effective strategy of management. But I don't know. Like, you know, the one thing you learn is these people are who they are. This is how they operate. They're convicted in what they believe works, and you know, it's not always going to work, and it's not always going to lead to healthy relationships. Not everyone's going to love it, but I think if there was one thing that I picked up was, you know, people have to have kind of high levels of expectation. They have to be willing to make difficult decisions, and they have to have kind of core beliefs that they stick with. And I think that's why you see some of these clashes sometimes.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, Craig. It's January 7th. Of the people that you write about in the franchise, is there anybody who's going to have a great spring and, say, make it 2, 3, or 4 rounds, say?
Oh, interesting. So, you know, the one kind of string that is pulled a little bit throughout a few of the chapters, you know, it goes from Lamoriello to Kyle Dubas, even into the Capitals chapter, is what Toronto should do with their young stars, because Kyle Dubas talked a lot about that when I talked to him, and just basically the process in which he analyzed that. And ultimately, Kyle didn't blow things up. Ultimately, Brad Treliving, who I also wrote about, didn't blow things up. You know, one of the things he said is these are players that you spend a lot of time trying to get, so you don't want to move away from the core. And, you know, I've believed in that strategy. I think that eventually that Toronto Maple Leafs, I know that's like, it's counter to years and years of history with that franchise, but I think that team will figure it out. And of all the teams that I look at and that, you know, were analyzed, I think that if you're saying this spring, who's going to have the best spring, that would be the one I'd point out.
And do I complain to you about the Athletics Connections game?
Yeah, I will take all complaints. Let me have them.
Well, I have to say that not knowing very much about sport, it's a fascinating game to play. And it's not as infuriating as the Times version, which pisses a lot of people off every day, it seems. It is a fun thing to play every day, I must say. Every morning I look forward to it.
It's great. It's actually been one of the fun things about being bought by the New York Times is our ability to kind of take some of the stuff that works for them and roll it out with the Athletic, and not to turn this into like a, you know, company promo, but that's a great example. Like, Connections is this massive hit for the New York Times, and I don't know what the number is. Millions of people play it, and it's fun, and it's, like you said, infuriating, but a challenge. And that was one of the things we're like, oh, how amazing would it be to have a sports version of that? And so to see it out in the wild now, and I, you know, I saw behind the scenes the months of development that went into that. The editor, Mark Cooper, is the guy that if you have to complaints about who's doing it, I can tell you, Mark, send the complaints to him. He's the puzzle master on that one, and it's really fun to see the sports version of that live.
Yeah, the other day there was one where they had logos on it. And I remember when the Times Connections version had pictures one day, how that was upsetting to a lot of people. But it works better for sports, doesn't it?
I think so. Yeah. I think it's fun. I like even the Wordle. Like, I've seen sports versions of Wordle where you're doing that.
And yeah,
it's really fun. Like the New York Times games, its tone, it's fun creation. And I can just tell you a quick story. I was boarding a plane once, and the woman in front of me was the editor of, I think, Wordle for the New York Times. Mm. Just randomly, we were on the same flight.
Yeah.
And she was posing for pictures from people who are fans of the New York Times Wordle. Like, they knew her from TikTok, because apparently she has the Wordle has a TikTok account. And I said, oh, my gosh, like, this is how these games are connecting with people, that people are out there taking pictures with the editor, which is, I love to see that.
Yeah, I'm a subscriber of The Athletic now for a couple of years. You have to read Thomas Drantz and Harmon Dial if you want to know what's going on with the Canucks, and there's a lot there that's even, you know, I find, you know, these long features that you do on certain aspects of the various games, I found that just fascinating to read. This book as well is just a terrific read. Congratulations on the franchise and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today, Craig.
Well, I appreciate the conversation. It was really fun. Thanks for having me.
The website for more is at craigcustins.com. The book is called The Franchise, The Business of Building Winning Teams. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Its author, Craig Custins, joined me from Detroit in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.